From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
As the House prepares to vote on a sweeping election reform bill, let's take a dive into the details. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnists Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn. The bill on the House side is numbered H.R. 1, and the title is the For the People Act of 2021. And it's essentially an overhaul of federal elections in the U.S., federalizing a lot of the rules, overruling a lot of the state legislation on this issue. And since many of those details don't make the headlines, it's probably worth going through some of them. So to start, the bill would hugely expand mail balloting. And as the legislation goes through, there might be amendments, but here's a line from the text as it was introduced. If an individual in a state is eligible to cast a vote in an election for federal office, the state may not impose any additional conditions or requirements on the eligibility. And so, Kim, there's that provision, which essentially says everybody has a right to mail ballot, no excuses. There are other provisions that say mail ballots can't have any requirement that they have notaries or witness signatures. There's a few states that operate that way, but it would be a real change to impose that on all 50.
Yeah, I think that's the important thing that you just mentioned, is what a striking shift this would be for most states. Because as a result of COVID, we got a lot of mail-in voting this last election, and we heard a lot about states that do it all the time, places, for instance, like Oregon. But in most states, state law requires you to have, for instance, a reason sometimes. If you're going to get a mail-in ballot, for instance, you have to say that you're not going to be present in the state on the day, or you're too infirm to get to the polls. Other states allow more widespread use of mail ballots, but you have to submit identification. You have to request the ballot. Some states have requirements that you have to, for instance, have a mail-in ballot notarized or viewed by a witness as you sign it, as a sort of form of security. This would get rid of all of that. And it would produce this kind of widespread, very few rule mail-in voting that we saw in COVID. Because Democrats are putting this in, let's to be very clear, they're going to claim it's because they want, you know, more people to have access to the ballots, but they fundamentally understand they're creating a system in which you can't really have any oversight, and that tends to favor Democrats in elections.
And so one argument against this bill, I suppose, would be that we have a long tradition of having election day, and people who cannot be there on election day, you make a provision for them. But that's supposed to be an exception, and it's becoming not the exception. I mean, in North Carolina, I think it's notable that North Carolina sends out absentee ballots 60 days before the election. And, I think there's an argument that there's a lot that can happen in a campaign in 60 days.
Yeah, I agree. Look, what Kim was talking about is we have taken the pandemic exception. What they're trying to do is take the pandemic exceptions that we made the last year to account for COVID-19 and make it permanent, these emergency rules that all open the door for a lot of mischief. And I think that's why the Democrats want it. You know, when Kim said there's no enforcement, basically the tradition in the Constitution leaves a lot of the rules up to the states. We're a state-based system. And this would basically federalize that. Instead of state legislatures debating what we should do, should we have a voter ID, should we do this, what we'll have is the federal government and the courts setting out things. These things will all transfer to the courts. One of the interesting provisions of this is it limits any legal challenges, court challenges, to the DC courts. Right, to that jurisdiction. So even if you had a dispute in Louisiana or Montana, that's where it's going to be decided. And this is I believe, a huge break with America tradition and so forth. And I think it's basically taking any of these guardrails off the elections and making all the problems and all the distrust that we saw in 2020, it's going to be routine now.
And on the mail balloting point, there's also a provision in the bill titled uniform deadline for acceptance of mailed ballots. And essentially that uniform deadline would be 10 days after Election Day, again, nationwide, provided that the ballots that are sent in have a postmark on them. But Kim, I mean, I think there were, this was in dispute last year, and I think there are big questions, big problems that people could raise about that.
Well, look, one of the things that is happening out in the states, and it's worth pointing this out, because even as Democrats are pushing this bill, which would essentially federalize elections, it would give the federal government incredible new ability to dictate to states how to run their elections. That is happening even as state governors and state legislatures across the country are reevaluating what happened in 2020 and moving a very different direction to sort of tighten up their election security and to make sure that the integrity of the vote is maintained. And why are they doing that? In part because you've had enormous growing amounts of distrust in the system. And one of the things that fed that the most were all of these states where they allowed these mail-in ballots to just dribble in after the deadline. And so what Americans ended up seeing was one result on election night, and then the erosion of those vote totals and changes, which really undermined their faith in the system. So imagine a new regime in which, you know, we did this every time we went through, and in which you don't have a result on the day, but you end up with, you know, potentially months of wrangling and haggling and recounts over the last votes and what and who, how are they counted and who did it and were observers allowed to watch, and then not getting results in some of these places for a long time. We had a situation in New York's 22nd congressional district where we didn't have a victor there for 97 days. So this seems to be a recipe for setting up endless messy situations like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's my concern. And you don't have to subscribe to theories about widespread fraud to worry about this. And it's just what you're talking about, Kim. It's putting ambiguity in the system. And I mean, my recollection of the 2000 Florida recount is that one of the issues there was ballots that were not definitively for one candidate or another. They had these punch card ballots, and sometimes the punch didn't go through, and so you had a ballot where it was indented, and you know, the question is that a clear signal of the voter's intent? And after that, there were attempts to wring that kind of ambiguity out of the election system. And, you know, I worry this is putting some of it back in, and not to beat a dead horse, because we talked about this, I think, last week. But in Pennsylvania, they took ballots 3 days late, and there were 10,000 of them that showed up. And that was when it wasn't even 100% clear that those ballots were going to be counted. So people were trying not to be late. And almost 7% of those ballots did not have legible postmarks. So imagine the 2024 election when people are told, yeah, please send your ballot on election day. That's fine as long as it shows up 10 days later. It's hard not to imagine that you might have thousands of ballots that showed up late without postmarks, without any proof of when they were mailed. And then again, the question is, what do you do about that? One side is going to say, look at the law. There's no postmark. These are invalid ballots. The other side is going to get affidavits from some of those voters who say, you know, I swear under oath that I mailed my ballot 2 days before the election. And here's a timestamp photo that my wife took of me, putting the ballot in the mailbox. And we went to the gas station, and here's my receipt after from that day. And that puts courts in a really bad situation. You know, the voter saying, I did everything right. It was the post office that screwed up. You can't disenfranchise me. And Bill, I mean, I don't know why. I get that this requires a very close election for this kind of problem to arise, but I don't know why we would want to make close elections even more contentious and ambiguous than they already are.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. In fact, some of the things you laid out are the arguments Clarence Thomas used to criticize his own court for not taking up that Pennsylvania case. Look, in that case, I think there were only 10,000 votes at issue, so it wouldn't have changed the election if they all went to Trump instead of to Joe Biden. But as Thomas pointed out, in the future it might be different. It might be enough votes that that go against the margin. And what you're laying out is one of the biggest problems here is that we're not only changing the law, we're changing the authority behind the law. The reason that the Supreme Court should have taken this case up is because the Constitution leaves it to the state legislatures to set the to make the election law. And basically what you had in Pennsylvania is a court de facto making the law there. And we're going to see a lot of this. What we're going to see is the courts involved. As you said, all those nasty kind of predictions you had about disputes and so forth, the courts are going to be filled with them going forward if this passes. And I think we get the worst parts of the federal government. We get the Supreme Court declining to intervene where it should have intervened. It should say, Pennsylvania, your legislature, you can make the laws you want, but you got to follow your own rules. That would have been a perfectly appropriate thing. Instead, we're going to have endless litigation over that these provisions cause. They've changing the authority behind it, and basically they're stripping the states of their classic role as putting the guardrails on elections.
Hang tight, we'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
ADP knows anything you hear, anything you don't hear, anything you kinda heard, anything you weren't supposed to hear and now have to pretend like you didn't, can change the world of work. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. One last thought on the mail ballot point, and that is this issue of ballot collection or ballot harvesting. And there's a couple provisions in this bill, H.R. 1, that seem to suggest that there would be no limits on that. So one says that states shall permit a voter to designate any person to return a voted and sealed absentee ballot, so long as the person designated to return the ballot does not receive any form of compensation based on the number of ballots returned. And then right after that, there's a provision that says states may not put any limit on how many voted and sealed absentee ballots any designated person can return. So, Kim, I mean, as I read that, that means that you can, A, be paid as long as you're not paid per ballot, but you can have a staff of a campaign or a partisan organization that's paid that goes around to homes and neighborhoods and nursing homes and stacks up hundreds or thousands of ballots.
Yeah, let's be clear what a big business this is too. Okay, this is ballot harvesting only really kind of came into the lexicon widely last year as people were having a lot of discussions about this COVID election. But it's been around for a long time, and Democratic political operatives are exceptionally good at it. Okay, they've been using it in places like California for years. And I think what a lot of people don't understand is that in many states, the ability to get a hold of very detailed voter data about where people live, how they tend to vote, et cetera, it's totally possible. And these organizations have it down to a science. And so one of the problems with the ballot harvesting provision is that you're fundamentally changing the nature of the kind of election game in that, you know, in the past, people have talked about get out the vote efforts. You want to motivate your side to get that ballot turned in or to go to the polls on the day. This is something fundamentally different. This is an organization that can go out and you know, bully people into returning their ballots or pressure them, only do it in certain areas and not others. These are not like Good Samaritans whose goal is just to get everybody to vote. They're about making sure that they get more of their votes from their side and depressing votes from the others. And it's also an opportunity for all kinds of mischief, right? If you have somebody that's going out and quote, you know, collecting ballots, you have no guarantee. Let's say they go into a nursing home and they go knock door to door and they say, here, I'm a Good Samaritan, I'll take your ballot back in. But this happens to be a place where they think that there might be a lot of Republican voters. Do they end up in a trash can along the way? Do they actually make it back? So this is why a lot of states outright ban it. But again, one of the problems with this bill is it's going to trump state laws. Even as a lot of governors right now are trying to reform things for the better, this bill would override them.
Well, I mean, I presume that if a ballot collector, harvester, whatever, intentionally threw away ballots, I mean, I presume that that would still be able to be punished. But even if you set aside bad intent, Bill, I mean, if this becomes a real widespread practice, there's going to be mix-ups and screw-ups. I mean, somebody was out collecting ballots and had a box of 150 in the trunk and forgot to take it out of the trunk and finds them, you know, 2 weeks or 2 months later. I mean, I can't help but think that would be really corrosive to people's confidence in the election.
Yeah, it sounds like standard operating procedure in Chicago or something. I think the bill is so corrupting, again, not only just by the provisions, as you rightly point out, that there's so many chances for mischief, and there's going to be so much acrimony and so many court decisions. So we're going to be involving in the federal courts in ways I think the founders never intended. The other process thing that I find really troubling about this is that to get this through, my impression is that if this were to go through the Senate, they got to abolish the filibuster. I don't think they'll get enough Republican votes otherwise. So here we have again this very dubious law with dubious provisions and that will cause a fundamental change in how the Senate does business if they're going to get it through. To me, every aspect of this bill looks very, very troubling and moves us away. And I'm more concerned actually about the process questions, because when you do a bad process, you get a bad outcome. And I'm more concerned about the constitutional process here than I am about any of the specific provisions, because it just moves us in a terrible direction. And Kyle, everything you have rightly laid out, I think, is going to be dropped in the lap of federal court. There'll be courts, you know, disputing different things. And I do not see how this is a prescription for fair elections and people's trust in it. And I'll add one thing. Every article I read about this talks about the need for expanding the franchise to get people to vote. We just had a year where Donald Trump got more votes than any Republican in history. And Joe Biden got even more votes than any Democrat in history. I mean, we had a tremendous turnout for voting. So I don't quite see why, where the need is for this, that people are being actively disenfranchised. And, you know, you mentioned before Election Day and so forth. I'm old fashioned. I believe people should have to show some effort. I think it's possible to make it too easy if we're not also concerned about election security.
Or even if you are an advocate for expanding the franchise, I mean, I do think there are also just reasonable questions about doing it from Congress. I mean, Congress's power is limited. And if you read some of these provisions closely, you'll notice that it says they apply to federal elections. And so one of the other questions I have, Kim, is if this could create situations where you end up with two sets of rules. And I'll give one example. So HR 1 says essentially that there are some states that have disenfranchisement provisions for people who have been committed or found guilty of felonies. And HR 1 says that they automatically get the right to vote back as long as they are no longer imprisoned. But again, that provision applies for federal elections, which seems like it would set up a conflict with states that have in their state constitutions provisions for disenfranchisement. And so you end up with a situation, Kim, I mean, again, at least it looks like to me, where if you're a county elections official, do you have to run two sets of voter lists and have two sets of ballots, because some people can vote in federal elections and not state elections?
Yeah, that mess that you are describing is precisely why we have always largely left it to the states to come up with their own election rules, right? I mean, the federal government in the entire history of this country has essentially set the day, set certain wide provisions, for instance, about how you elect presidents, for instance, you know, all the questions about the electoral college, et cetera. But in terms of the process by which states decide who are on their voter rolls and how you can actually go vote and whether or not you have mail-in voting and what the kind of rules are for how long and postmarks and everything, we've left that to the states because it makes sense for them to have a uniform voting system that applies both in their state elections and in their federal elections. And this really gets to, I don't think it can be underlined enough, just what a radical bill this is. It is overthrowing, you know, hundreds of years of dealing with elections out in the states, and with incredibly prescriptive, intrusive new demands on those states. And, you know, the situation you just described is just one example of the incredible mess that could end up as a result. You know, I think there's a lot of Democrats in Washington who say, well, you know, if we force states to do this, then they'll alter their own rules for their state level versions. But, you know, don't necessarily count on it. A lot of states might be really angry at the notion of being dictated to the rules. And so they might, out of just sheer anger, choose to keep two sets. And that's going to be a whole other problem.
And this is a bill. This bill is hundreds of pages long, so we can't get to everything. But a couple more things that stuck out to me. One is this this system of a public funding bill for small donors. As I understand it, it would be a 6-to-1 match up to $200. So people who give donations of $200 to certain candidates, those candidates could get $1,200 from the government. And I mean, one question there is why are we subsidizing private political candidates? Another question is what that would do to polarization, since these small donors tend to be very ideological. And I'll just go down the list here at Open Secrets. They have a list of who gets most of their funding from small donors. Number one is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, 80%, Bernie Sanders, 70%. Skip down a little bit, Jim Jordan, 66%, Matt Gaetz, 65%. You know, just below that, we have Adam Schiff and Ilhan Omar. So it's, I mean, the small donors are an ideological force in American elections. And Bill, I wonder what the consequences of amplifying that would be. 6-to-1.
Yeah, that's a lot of extra money. I mean, look, on principle, I'm opposed using the taxpayers' money to promote some candidates over the other. You know, some candidates, I think Bernie Sanders, you know, emphasizing his small donor, they use it as a fundraising asset. You know, vote for me because I'm just taking money from small guys like you. That's fine. I think that's entirely fair. Let them do it that way. I think with social media, with all these other things, there are ways for people to get their mention out. But the ultimate test is whether they can attract other support. And if they can't, I don't see why the taxpayers are propping up their campaigns.
And then one final one, near the end of the bill, Kim, there's a provision that would require the United States judiciary to create a code of conduct that covers Supreme Court justices. What do you make of that provision?
Well, this is in response to longtime complaints among the left that the Supreme Court currently is not bound by a code of conduct. There is a code of conduct for the judiciary. It's created, it's a set of ethical canons created by the Judicial Conference. But that code only applies to lower federal courts. And so this Congress has in the past looked at this issue and just tried to think about whether or not they should pass something. Now, H.R. 1 does include a provision, and specifically, it wouldn't allow the court to design its own ethical code, the Supreme Court. It would it also have the Judicial Conference design one and impose it upon the Supreme Court. And the real issue with this here is whether or not this isn't just a huge violation of the constitutional separation of powers. The idea that Congress can tell a separate and equal branch of government how it's going to abide and what kind of, you know, rules and regulations it's going to have. I think that if you actually got this bill through into law, it would be a very quick work before it would be challenged in court on those grounds.
But it also seems to me, Bill, last thought here, that it would, I mean, it could also help increase polarization of the Supreme Court. I mean, occasionally there are conflicts of interest or something. Some justice, you know, owns stock in something that's related to a case, and so he sits a case out. But at the Supreme Court level, there's when a justice does that, there's no extra justice waiting in the wings to come in and fill out the bench. And if you have an externally imposed code of conduct, I mean, I think you would just get a huge increase in partisan calls for justices to recuse for one reason or another.
Yeah, we already have some of that. I mean, I see that the people promoting this provision are again bringing up Dick Cheney going hunting with Antonin Scalia. I think we'll get a lot more frivolous charges and so forth. I'm not sure that the code that the justices live by today needs updating or needs a change. I think we'll get a lot more litigation and, as you say, a lot more politics in these charges going forward. And I don't think there'd be an increase in the morality or ethics of the Supreme Court. It's just, to me, it just seems like another vehicle for politicizing the court and giving partisans, things to swing at the justices with.
Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.